Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. For more information about Beyond the Book and Copyright Clearance Center, please go to www.beyondthebook.com.
I want to turn now to Peter Gollenbach. Peter is the author of many, many books on sports, most recently a novel, actually, Seven, the Mickey Mantle novel. And the other book titles have included Wrigleyville, Wild High and Tight, The Life of Billy Martin, Bums, and the New York Times bestsellers Dynasty, The Bronx Zoo, written with Sparky Lyle, Number One with Billy Martin, and Balls with Greg Nettles. Peter lives in St. Petersburg, Florida. Welcome to the panel, Peter.
Thank you very much. I
was intrigued to learn that you began your own sports writing career as a correspondent from a certain small town in New Hampshire. And there was already, though, a kind of foreshadowing of the direction your writing would take. Tell us about that.
Well, I didn't know it. I mean, I was a freshman at Dartmouth College, and I started working for the Dartmouth, which was the campus newspaper. And I guess I was pretty good at it because, you know, very soon they asked me if I would be the campus correspondent to the New York Times. And they were paying me $5 an article. You know, you'd write two paragraphs in a box score, and they said you can write about any sport you want to. And for crying out loud, they had dozens and dozens of different sports. I thought, boy, I'm going to get rich. And I was making a good $30 a week doing that. I was one of the wealthiest guys on campus.
That was good walking around money in those days.
Yeah.
But there was also a figure on campus who became important to you, who did relate to the future of your career.
It's kind of amazing how it works like that. When I was a kid, I discovered a book called The New York Yankees by Frank Graham. And I have no idea why this book meant so much to me, but I must have read it 100 times. Because in this book, he had conversations with Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, and I think the book came out in like 1946, something like that. And this was the history of the Yankees. Frank Graham was this wonderful sports writer, one of the guys who wrote conversations, as opposed to just facts. I was always interested in the people, more so than exactly what they did. Though if you were a Yankee fan, you knew they were going to win. And so the athletic director at Dartmouth was a fellow by the name of Red Rolfe, who turned out to be, he was a third baseman for those Yankees during the 30s and the 40s. And when he was there, he was sort of on his way out. I mean, everybody wanted him to leave. All the coaches wanted a new guy, wanted new blood. Red was kind of a pain in the ass. The baseball coach wanted him gone. But to me, he was like a god. You know, I was like a 16-year-old freshman at Dartmouth College, and this was Red Rolfe, who had played ball with Lou Gehrig and played ball with Joe DiMaggio, and it was a chance for me to sit with him and ask him about these guys. And so I became sort of a pet of Red's, because here was this kid who actually cared about him and cared about his career. And I didn't realize it, but, you know, Red Rolfe was the first of probably 400 interviews that I've had with former Major League players. It was magical for me.
Well, that's terrific the way it's, you know, life really began that early for you.
Amazing.
In your career, and it would continue that way. Tell us about how you pitched your first book idea, and that then became the bestseller.
Well, also a unique kind of a thing. I after Dartmouth, I went to NYU Law School, where I spent most of my time hanging out with the Knicks and the Rangers and the Yankees and then the Jets and the Giants. I mean, I was not a very good law student, and I knew just enough, you know, to get by. And I got my first job working for Friedman and Fishman, and I lasted there 6 weeks because they handed me this stack of cases, and they said, okay, we want you to handle these. And in six of them, the statute of limitations had run. Now, that's a six-year statute of limitations where if you let the statute run, your client cannot get into court. And you can be disbarred for that. So either Friedman or Fishman, one of the two of them said, you know, here's this pile of cases, and I brought them back to him and said, hey, the statute run on these six cases, and he said to me, okay, you know, call these people up and tell them why they don't have a case. And I said, I quit. And that was it. And then I went to the New York Times, and I got myself a job at Prentice Hall as a journalist, writing about President Nixon's wage and price controls. And this was the summer of 1972, and I discovered the whole thing was kind of a fraud because all the prices were allowed to go up, but none of the wages. It's a sort of Republican duplicity that perhaps we've seen before. At any rate, after 6 weeks, I found a trade book catalog from Prentice Hall, and I thought to myself, well, you know, I can write a book better than the stuff I'm seeing in this catalog. And I ran downstairs just to knock on the door of the trade book editor's office, and it was such a small operation that he didn't even have a secretary, and so he says, come in. And I went in, and I told him, look, you know, during the 16 years between 1949 and 1964, the Yankees won 14 pennants and 9 world championships. This would make a great book. And not only that, every year they had more than 1 million in attendance, so that's 16 million people. And if I can sell books to just 1% of those people, we'll have a bestseller. He says, okay, I'll give you a contract.
And
that's what happened. And it doesn't happen very often. And actually, I told that story to the Bergen Record in the first article about this particular book after it came out. And DiCicco received 60, 70 book proposals. And they were all terrible.
He didn't take any of them. Well, that was a wonderful stroke of luck for you. But then something happened. You worked on the book for almost a year, researching the record of those years, and determined that that was hardly going to be enough.
Well, I went to Yankee Stadium, and the Yankees, Bob Fischel was the PR guy, and Marty Appel, who's still a close friend of mine, was his assistant. And they said, sure, you can, you know, do whatever research you want. We've got all these newspaper articles in our files, and you're welcome to hang with us. And I became sort of an unpaid member of the Yankees during the 1972-73 season. Steinbrenner came along right after that and fired everybody. But this was before everybody got fired. And so they let me hang around, and after I had compiled all my information with which I was going to write this book, it occurred to me quite, you know, in the pit of my stomach that none of this information was worth a damn. In other words, I hadn't quite formulated it, but if you're going to write a book, the idea is you're going to write something that somebody's never read before. You know, you better give them something new, or, you know, it's not worth doing it. And so I went back to DiCicco and said, look, I need it. He gave me $2,500 to start. So at the end of the year, I went back to him and I said, look, you know, I need to interview these guys. Will you give me another $2,500? And he said, yes. If he had said no, my career was over. I would have owed him $2,500, and, you know, I don't know what I would have done. But he said, yeah, so he gave me $2,500. I started going around the country interviewing. You know, I started with Jim Constanti and ended up with Mantle and Maris and Cleet Boyer and Whitey Ford and everybody who played on the Yankees. I went to see them, interviewed them all. I had to go back for another $2,500 and yet a fourth $2,500. And each time the guy gave me the money. And that enabled me to finish the book.
Well, tell us about the first meeting with Mickey. And, you know, he told you something that must have struck you and I'm imagining became the seed that got planted that wound up being this new book.
But yeah, without a doubt.
Tell us about that.
I'd called Mickey. The Yankees were wonderful to me, just wonderful. And they gave me access to all the telephone numbers of all their former Yankees. If I tried to do this today, the Yankees are so rotten today that I couldn't even get in the door. You know, they'd have hung up on me. But you know, I'd been hanging around for a year and made friends with all these people. And they said, sure, here's our list of alumni with their addresses and telephone numbers, which certainly made, you know, David can tell you, that's the trick of these things. Find out where these people are. And sometimes that's the hardest part. And so I called Mickey at home, and he said, sure, come over to the house. I'll be glad to talk to you. And I showed up and knocked on the door. And, you know, I guess it was Merlin who answered. And I said, where's Mickey? And she said, he's in New York. Well, apparently Mickey, you know.
Mickey was being Mickey.
Mickey was being Mickey. And so I got on the plane, went to New York, and I met him there in the clubhouse. And we talked for over an hour, and he proceeded to tell me some of the most intimate aspects of his life. I mean, the thing I discovered about Mickey is you could generally ask him anything, and he would give you, if he trusted you, an open, honest answer. And so among the things he told me about, I was the first person he told about his fears. Mickey had retired in 68, and this was 72 or 73. And so Mickey said to me, he said, at night, I go to sleep, and I have this dream that I'm standing outside of Yankee Stadium. And I can hear the public address announcer going, now batting in the third position, number 7, Mickey Mantle, and I can't find the door to get inside the stadium. And I can hear Casey Stengel saying, where's Mickey? Where's Mickey? And I can't get in. And he said, and I would wake up in a cold sweat. You know, which was very, very interesting. I mean, Mickey was one of those athletes who should have dropped dead on the day that he quit, because he just could not figure out what he wanted to do with the rest of his life. And he really wasn't equipped to do anything with the rest of his life. He was fortunate because he was so incredibly famous, and people would pay him money to go to dinners or go to openings of malls or that sort of thing. And people, beginning about 87 or 88, would pay him $25, $30, $40 to sign his name to a piece of paper, which Mickey also thought was, you know, totally ridiculous. What I loved about Mickey was that he did not think he was any big deal. Mickey could not understand why people were so gaga about him, which was a totally endearing quality about him. Plus, he was one of the funniest people I've ever had the pleasure of sitting with. We'd be sitting in a bar, and he would be telling these incredibly raucous jokes, many of which I put in this book. I mean, this is a very, very funny book, because Mickey was a very, very funny person. I find it unbelievably ironic that the New York Post ripped me a new you-know-what for being so... They said it was pornographic, and then, of course, they should come out after following, you know, poor Alex Rodriguez around, Stray Rod. Still one of the great, you know, in history, that will go down as one of the great headlines of sports history. But, you know, the fact that they're following this guy around, there's something, you know, very sleazy and sort of semi-disgraceful about all of that.
But the thing that's different with this book, of course, is that you got an opportunity, because it's a novel, to imagine things that didn't necessarily happen and write them.
Well, I mean, the things that are in this book are things that happen. What I had to do, I mean, I was forced to do it. I mean, the reason I called it a novel is that if I had not called it a novel, the New York Post would have ripped me a new one for not being able to establish my sources. You know, I didn't want to. Who was that fellow with a million little lies? James Fry. I didn't want to be James Fried. So I deliberately called it the Mickey Mantle novel. But all of these things in this book happen. What I didn't have the opportunity to interview anybody about, because the people who told me these stories had passed away, was the details. And so the things that are in this book happened. But I must tell you, the details of it, for a number of these stories, I had to imagine.
And yet you got an opportunity, because it was a novel, to imagine yourself as Mickey.
Well, amazingly enough. I mean, it's you sort of transform yourself. I wrote this thing in the first person with Mickey telling the story. This is the autobiography Mickey would have written had he had somebody like me to sit with him and do it. But he had passed on in 1995, and so unfortunately I sort of had to do it myself.
Well, your sports writing career then goes back 35 years or more. What is it about sports writing today that you admire, and what is it that you find lacking?
Well, the sports writers I admire are the ones I read. You know, David here is as good as anybody on the planet, and Michael Lewis is I find amazing, because what Michael can do, what's just incredible to me, he started off with Moneyball interviewing a whole raft of general managers, apparently, to write a book about exactly what, I'm not sure. But when he came across Billy Beane of the Oakland A's, he discovered something, and he discovered something very, very important. And he's got this, you know, incredible mind, where he takes all of this, it's like sculpturing, where you take a big blob of clay and you sculpture it away until you come up with a Brancusi, you know, and that's what Michael Lewis did. He had one scene in Moneyball where he's got all the scouts sitting in the room on this side, and he's got this kid sitting over here with a computer, and they're trying to figure out who to draft. So he says to the scout, who should we get? And the scout throws a name out. And Bean goes, nah, I don't think we want him. And so he goes to the guy with the computer and says, who should we get? And he says, well, this guy last year hit so-and-so, and his on-base percentage is so-and-so. We ought to draft this guy. And the guy goes, okay, we'll draft him. The next scout, and he declines his recommendation. He comes back over to this guy, and he takes his recommendation. Well, before we're done, he fires all scouts. He determines that the scouting system is ridiculous, and that the guy with the computer with the numbers will tell you who to take. And that's what his book was all about. And it was an incredible revelation. And the other thing that's amazing, of course, is that today you've got a number of teams who do what Billy Bean does. And then you've got other teams, like my Tampa Bay Devil Rays, who don't. You know? And you say to yourself, well, wait a second. Michael Lewis in Moneyball has just told every Major League Baseball team how to be the most efficient and to be the most smart. Why isn't everybody doing this? And you discover that baseball has a tradition, which is very, very, very difficult to break. And so, you know, teams with young, hip guys, they're more willing to go out on a limb and do something different than the teams with the guys who are not so young and not so hip.
And sports now is much more a part of the entertainment culture than really its own separate world.
Well, the thing you discover watching ESPN is that a lot of my contemporaries are now no longer so much writing the sports, but they're the guys. Tony Kornheiser, who's one of the great sports writers in America, he's now on TV arguing with Mike Wilpon, who is another of the great sports writers in America, but now they're making their money being TV talking heads.
Or Buster Olney, who had
Buster
season covering the Yankees when they first won the World Series.
Buster wrote a fabulous book on the New York Yankees. Buster's one of the very best, but now Buster's a TV guy.
They're making more money that way. That is one of the ways that sports writing has really diminished.
Yes.
I must tell you, it's much more difficult today to write about sports in books than it ever was. And I'll tell you, among the reasons is that publishers today now want more than anything, they want fame. They want celebrity. It's very difficult to write a book about the 1908 Cubs and find somebody who will actually publish it. I mean, that's a coup. It must be, I'm sure, a fabulous book because she got that published. But today, they want A-Rod's story. And of course, you as a writer, if you get A-Rod's story, where A-Rod gets $1 million, he gives you $50,000. You know, it's because he's got an agent who wants to make sure that A-Rod gets 110% of the book deal.
Right.
You know, it's hard.
I mean, do you think the players in 1908 thought of themselves as anything particularly special? They were just having some fun and lucky to get paid for it?
Well, I think the really great players always have a sense of being something special, of being, you know, gifted far beyond ordinary mortals. Although I came across a series of newspaper articles that Hannes Wagner did, in which he gets very testy. He thought people didn't respect the amount of work he did. But he was clearly, I mean, frankly, all great athletes are something of freaks. I mean, they can just do things we can't do. I think the big difference is that today in the major sports, your life is quite separate from the lives that ordinary people lead. You know, Yogi Berra used to go home in the winter and sell suits, and I think that connects you much more.
He was
but
good at
Peter
it. He
David
was good at it.
No, all my guys are dead.
Well, most athletes today have a sense of entitlement from age 11. You know, they're separated from the rest of the kids at school. And so by the time they're 18, they do have this, you know, and a lot of, you know, maybe 1% of those will make the major leagues or the NBA or you know, the NFL. But there's a whole lot of kids who have really traumatic experiences from age 18 to 24 when they realize they're not going to make it. But but the ones who do make it, that sense of entitlement is even more enhanced. And so then when their careers end, then they're really in trouble. a lot of them.
Some people have said that basketball is the worst thing that has ever happened to the black community. And the reason for that is I discovered in my research that of the high school ball players, one out of every 10,000 high school ball player makes it to the pros. And it may even be less now because they're going to Europe, to Estonia and places like that to get professional basketball players. But these kids in the 7th and 8th grade, almost every single one of them, if you interview them, will tell you that they're going to be professional basketball players. And so some sociologists wonder if perhaps they take the basketball away and not make that an option, perhaps some more, some of these kids would study harder, work harder to go to college.
Well, on that, I want to thank everybody here from Lawrence to Gollenbach to Murphy to Marinus. It's a great play, and we really enjoyed having you all here. Thank you as well for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center, with conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists. Beyond the Book is the premier source for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond.